In 1973, I was just a very young man, was married, didn't have any children, was working for the Church of Christ in St. Albans, West Virginia. And Ronnie Wade asked me if I would be interested in moving to Missouri and working with the Chain of Rocks Church that was in St. Louis. And that sounded exciting to me. And I told my wife, I said, I think that's what we ought to do, and let's do it. And so we moved to St. Louis, Missouri that year. And we had two of our children were, well, Jonathan was born in the process of moving just before we moved there. And then we moved to St. Louis, and our next son, Isaac, was born there in St. Louis. When I was in St. Louis, I met some folks that visited the congregation one evening. Their names were Jack and Mary Young, and they visited the congregation and said that they went to a Church of Christ that was on Lillian Avenue, and they were just, their congregation no longer met of an evening because the neighborhood was so rough and it was dangerous, and they were looking for a place that they could come and go to evening services. And I welcomed them. I looked at them as prospects to perhaps convert and be a part of the congregation that was there at Chain of Rocks. Jack asked me if I knew Carl Ketcherside, and I said, no, I really don't. I said, never even heard of him before. And that was an incredible thing to Jack Young. He said, well, you need to go hear him. And he told me that Brother Ketcherside would be speaking at a certain place on an evening. And so the wife and I went to hear Carl Ketcherside. And I have to admit, I was young, I was impressionable, and I was sort of like those soldiers that we read about in the Gospel of John when they had been sent to arrest Jesus and they came back empty-handed. I had never heard a man speak like this. And he was perhaps the greatest orator that I've ever heard in my life. And he was a very well-versed man in the Bible. Knowledgeable, personable, and a great individual. And I say all of that, but the slide that I have here, where I call the title of these remarks, A Voice of One Wandering in the Orchard, notice that I have Matthew chapter 7, verses 15 through 20, which speaks about, you can tell what type of a tree it is by the fruit that it bears. And the things that I heard in those years, I wondered about them. I was very cautious, and I was an individual that needed more evidence than just what someone was saying, but I thought time will tell. Time has told. I believe the fruit that was born by the things that Brother Ketcherside taught has shown that he was mistaken in the path that he had taken. But nevertheless, I think that I have grown just because that I knew him. Let me tell you a little bit about him. Carl Ketcherside was born in the state of Missouri in a little town called Cantwell. And when he was 12 years old, he obeyed the gospel. It was in 1920, and it was an elder by the name of Jesse Jackson from the Old Pearl, Illinois Church of Christ that baptized him. The family had moved by the time that Carl was 12 years old because that his dad was no longer able to work in the lead mines there in Cantwell. And he was baptized in the creek that was flowing through the pastures of a brother whose name was John Willard. 3 months later, Carl Ketcherside gave his first sermon. He was sort of put on the spot. There was a preacher that had traveled through by the name of J.C. Bunn, and he simply announced on Sunday evening that Carl Ketcherside was going to give a sermon a month from that night. Carl went home and he started studying, and he gave his first sermon, and it was called Counting the Cost. Everybody liked it, and in fact, that night he was being booked to speak at other places during the next month. By the time he was 13 years old, Carl Ketcherside was catching a train and riding to various places to preach, and he had speaking engagements over a great bit of the state of Illinois, and then they moved to Kansas, and he continued to have speaking engagements just as a teenager. He had prepared himself for this earlier in life. He was a very intelligent young man. When he started first grade, he was promoted to second grade 2 weeks later. And by December, he was promoted to third grade. And at the end of the year, he had finished the fourth grade. And so that gives you an idea of the intellect that the young man had. And he loved to read. In fact, when he was there in school, the only library that he was exposed to was what I used to call the bookmobile, but they called it a traveling library that came to the school once a week. He was allowed to check out four books each week, and he would check out four books, read each one of them twice, and wait for the next arrival of the bookmobile. When he was moved again to Kansas with his family, he was introduced to the Carnegie Library, and there he began checking out books and reading a book a day, which in the biography that I read of him, it said that he did that for 7 years. When I knew him in St. Louis, and he was much older than just 20 years old by then, he still was reading a book a day. And he would oftentimes, in our interaction with one another, he would come by my house, or I would see him someplace, and he would open up the trunk of his car, be full of books, and he would say, I've got some books that I've read here this month. I'm just trying to get rid of them. And he would offer them to me or to anyone that was there that would promise that they would read the books that were there. So he was a man with a great mind. And he was an individual that never forgot a name, never forgot a face. He knew people. If you were introduced to Carl Ketcherside, he would remember you 10, 20 years later. He could see you out of pocket, as we would say, walking through a Walmart, and he would stop and greet you by name and ask about the family and talk about things that he knew about you. In fact, I've told this story to several of you here. The first evening that I met Carl Ketcherside, he was at the front door of the church building where he was going to be speaking. And when Jack and Mary Young brought me in and said, this is Richard Bunner, Carl gave me a warm handshake and said, I'm so glad you're here tonight, Richard. He says, what relationship are you to Mary Waters? Now, some of you may not know, but Irvin Waters' wife is a cousin of mine. She was a Bunner. And Carl starts telling me, says, Mary's from a place called Bunner's Ridge. Is that where you grew up? And he asked about the family and stuff. And I thought that was incredible that he would have that type of recall and memory of folks that he had met. And as often as I would take brethren that would come to visit me in St. Louis down, and we would go to hear Carl Ketcherside speak, he would remember who they were. He would know their relationship to brethren within within the fellowship that we circulate in. And he could tell me stories about things that were going on within the church, just as if he was a part of the people that we associate with on a regular basis. Well, that's the type of individual that he was. He was intelligent. He was a friendly individual, and he was a man that knew the Bible. If you disagreed with Carl Ketcherside on something, you better know your position well, because if he disagreed with you, he would make you think twice about where you were. By the time that I had met him, though, which was in 1974, he had changed from the man that he had been to an individual that was far different. And I will say this to his credit. He knew where I was within the church. He knew the things that I believed. And all the time, the months that we knew each other and visited with one another, he never once tried to change my doctrinal stance except on fellowship. And I'll talk about that here in just a little bit. Well, might point out that Carl Ketcherside, the type of orator that he was, when he was in high school, he entered a national oratory contest, and he had an instructor whose name was Wolf, a lady, and he came in the semifinals of this oratorical contest, and his final speech that was given was Benjamin Franklin and his relation to the relationship to the Constitution. And he made this statement concerning Miss Wolfe. He says, "I had got the taste of speaking to an audience and the taste of oratory. And by that time, I had learned what it meant to communicate to people on their level. Not to just get up and talk, but to communicate. If this woman never taught me anything else, she taught me that there was an art to communication." Well, in 1926, Carl Ketcherside graduated from high school. He studied briefly at the Topeka Business College on a scholarship, and he went to work at a secular job because that his penmanship was so excellent. And he worked for the Colombian Title and Trust Company, which relied on handwritten documents, and they wanted him to work for them. But he was speaking every Sunday someplace at a congregation that would be within a reasonable distance. And eventually he decided that he was going to preach the gospel full time. And so he quit his job and he began preaching. And he was on a very tight schedule because he was in demand every place that he could get to. And this was all in the Midwest. And he not only was called upon to preach the gospel, but he was called upon to speak at various other social activities and for various other organizations. He never was a member of any type of organization, but he had been elected as the chaplain of the Pacific Railroad in the area where he lived, and he became a safety lecturer for the railroad, and he spoke at many conventions, and he was constantly studying, reading books that he might be familiar with, whatever information that he could find about various places that he might be going to or people that he might be in contact with. In 1937, Carl Ketcherside moved to St. Louis. He was married now. He had married Nell Watson, and they had two children. And he was going to spend the rest of his life living in St. Louis. Now, While he was in St. Louis, Carl Ketcherside held a Bible reading. Let me give you a picture of the man here. This is when he was a young man. He held a Bible reading such as what Clint DeFrance talked that Daniel Sommer would have when he was preaching. Carl Ketcherside was actually a student of Daniel Sommer, was familiar with him, and believed many of the things that Daniel Sommer had taught. He was in that group of churches, and so he was familiar with all of the views and the thoughts that Daniel Sommer had. But in St. Louis, Carl Ketcherside would hold a study, an annual study, that would last for 8 weeks. And he taught every day in those studies from morning until evening, and two nights a week out of the time in that study. And he'd go through the entire Bible in 8 weeks. People would come from not only the Missouri area, but they would come from California, and they would come from Georgia. People would come from all over the United States just to study at the feet of Carl Ketcherside. And he was an individual that had the ability to hold people's attention and to teach them the Word of God. I was speaking to Rylan just a little bit before services, and I've told some of the others this. I never, of course, attended any of his annual studies. He no longer was doing those when I had moved to St. Louis. But one weekend he was going to teach on the book of Isaiah, and I went over to Alton, Illinois, where he was teaching, and he started at 9 o'clock in the morning on Saturday, and he just stood at the pulpit, had his Bible in his hand, and he began explaining the book of Isaiah, talking about the visions, the prophecies, and the historical background, and all of the information that could be gathered together. And after he had been talking for a little while, didn't seem like very long to me, he looked at his watch and he said, "I believe the sisters have lunch ready." He talked for 3 hours. Nobody had moved. People didn't get up to go to the bathroom. There wasn't rustling or noise. Folks just were listening to him. And we ate lunch and he came back out and he talked for another 3 hours. And I believe that most of us that were there could have sat for another 3 hours and listened to him as he explained the meaning and significance of the book of Isaiah. I'm sure that his Bible readings were of that quality and that caliber. And so people were learning from the studies that he was putting forth each year there in St. Louis. Now, during the 1930s, Carl Ketcherside was very busy, especially when he had moved to St. Louis. He did a radio program. He put out some books that were just the sermons from his radio program. He began putting out a little paper that he called, it was just meant to be a newsletter, called The Mission Messenger. He also was doing his Bible studies through the year. And then there was a debate that was held in 1937. Let me just back up a little bit here and say something about his relationship with Daniel Sommer. Sometime prior to his 25th birthday, there was a relationship that existed between Ketcherside and Sommer that was a very close bond. And in fact, in his first public debate that he had in 37, Ketcherside referred to this relationship, and he said, "Brother Sommer has of times remarked how he was the oldest and I was the youngest preacher in the brotherhood. He stood with his arm about my shoulder and mentioned the fact lovingly when he was last in my humble home. I have a letter in my briefcase which he wrote to me, and wherein he said that he wanted me to prepare to take his place when he had crossed the Dusky River. I think he said that he was about my age when Benjamin Franklin had said the same to him. Well, Brother Ketcherside was involved in numerous debates. Those of you that have read his debates will get this, and those that haven't won't. But he held debates with men like Rue Porter in Ozark, Missouri, on the subject of institutionalism, with G.C. Brewer in the winter of 1946 in St. Louis, Missouri, and then later with Brother Brewer at the Freed Hardeman College over the Christian College issue. He debated Burton Barber on the subject of instrumental music in Ottumwa, Iowa, in October of 1948. He debated G.K. Wallace at Paragould, Arkansas, on the subjects of located preachers and supporting Christian colleges in June of 1952. The Paragould debate was referred to as the cow pasture debate, as there wasn't a facility that was big enough to accommodate everyone that was there, so they rented a large tent and went about 4 or 5 miles out of town, and the debate was held in this tent in a pasture field. And then, of course, he debated Flavel Colley in a debate in Dallas over the question of located ministers. And in his biography, Pilgrimage of Joy, Ketcherside also references debates that he had with Sterl Watson. That was held in Hartford, Illinois. I'm not sure of the year. And with W.L. Toddy, that was held in Anderson, Indiana. I'm not sure of the year of that either. And there were other debates that he had. The ones that I mentioned earlier, that is the ones with Rue Porter or with Brewer or with G.K. Wallace, those are published debates, and you can still buy those and read them. You'll see that that Brother Ketcherside knew his material much better than those that he debated. His first debate was with Rue Porter, who was from Neosho, Missouri. Brother Porter was considered to be one of the best of debaters. And when Carl Ketcherside agreed to debate with Brother Porter, he was 28 years old and Brother Porter was 47 years old. And the propositions were like this. They were debating institutionalism. Ketcherside was opposed to orphan homes and homes for unwed mothers, or homes that would be nursing homes or whatever that would be church supported. And so he denied this in the first night of the debate, the first two nights, I should say. And then he talks here also about schools, and he was opposed to Bible colleges. Unlike Sommer, I think this is a difference, and Clint can correct me if I'm wrong on this. Ketcherside was opposed to Bible colleges, whether they were supported by the church or whether they were supported by individuals. Sommer was not opposed to Bible colleges that might have been supported as a private endeavor, as long as it didn't take church funds. But Brother Ketcherside was opposed to these. He would say that if it was church supported, that it was an extension of the church, there was no Bible basis for that, and that it was something that was wrong, should not be. And if it was going to be something that was private, he was opposed to that also, saying that it was an extension of the home, that there was no Bible authority for, and that people needed to be studying the Bible at home, that the teaching of the Bible was the obligation of the church, and the Bible should be studied taught by the church and studied in the home. and it was not the function of colleges to be teaching the Bible. Interesting in this debate, by the way, that was between Ketcherside and Porter, I mentioned the difference in their ages, and Brother Porter was not prepared for what was going to hit him. I mentioned that Ketcherside was 28. He had never debated before. Rue Porter had debated some 25 times. And when they entered the debate, Porter was condescending, and he referred to Ketcherside as a boy that had come to debate him, and referred to him repeatedly throughout the debate as a boy. And it ended up sort of like the David and Goliath match, because Ketcherside had the truth on the issue, and he was by far the superior debater in the match that was held. And during that time, Ketcherside was pressing Porter that they would have another debate, either in St. Louis or in Kansas City or in Springfield. But Brother Porter's brethren were not interested in having any more debates. And when Ketcherside was writing in his mission messenger, he would press for debates with any of the brethren that advocated the use of Bible colleges, the existence of Bible colleges, or orphan homes, as it would be. But there were not many that were takers to wanting to debate him. He proved himself to be a very capable and a very able debater. I copied this quote from his autobiography. He says, "I confess with some little regret and even a sense of shame that I delighted in such confrontations," that is, the debates that he was having. He said, "I liked being the gun-toter for a small party and taking on the best that the big mainline churches had to offer. Before I became convinced of the detrimentality of debates to the cause for which Jesus died, I debated most of the recognized gladiators of that area, of that era." Well, let's move on. Brother Ketcherside didn't have just a one-dimensional life. Let's talk about his publishing years. We want to talk about the influence that he had, and I'll say this. The influence that he had on churches was he taught brethren that are interested in the truth about whether or not it's right or wrong to have Bible colleges, and whether or not it's right or wrong to have institutions such as orphanages or old folks' homes that are going to be supported out of the church treasury. If you read his debates, you will find that he spells it out without any doubt. There's no doubt left in your mind as to what the Bible teaches in regard to these things. His publishing years, Brother Ketcherside began with publishing some books that he was not the author of, but many of us have these within our libraries today. We have The History of the Church Through the Ages by Robert Brumback, and we have Zur's Commentary that was printed. Ketcherside would advertise this as the first Bible commentary, the first complete commentary on the Bible, I should say, that was written by a member of the Church of Christ. Ketcherside and E.M. Zur were very close friends, and the entire commentary was written in Ketcherside's kitchen or study. E.M. Zur would come to his house each day, and for 4 hours a day, he would work on writing his commentary until it was done. And of course, he published some books from that Brother W.G. Roberts had written, One Lessons from Yesterday. All of these books, they're still available. Some are out of print, but they're easy to find. These books began a publishing career for Ketcherside, and then he began publishing books of his own. Now, the books that are on this page right here, they're excellent material. And I think the history of the church through the ages is a good read. I'm not big on referring to Zur's commentary, but it's a reasonable commentary. Brother Ketcherside began publishing books of his own. Those books that were published before 1957, they're good reads. He wrote A Clean Church. That's a good book. I think it's back there. Nathan has it for sale. The Royal Priesthood is a good book. I think it's worth the read. But then he starts writing books that are reflecting his change that he made doctrinally. And when you start reading that stuff, you need to be careful. You need to be sure that you're not going to be led astray. In fact, I just wouldn't recommend some of these books to some people if you're not very certain about where you are spiritually, because some of what he writes sounds good, but I know the end of where he ends up, because these things that he writes, he had this view that he was going to bring all of the people of God together, and he didn't do that. And in fact, his voice is it's not heard at all today in the way that he would want it to be heard. So there was a change that occurred in his life. And he, in his autobiography, gives a very lengthy description of what occurred. He was in Belfast, Ireland, and he will tell you that it was on March the 27th, 1951. He had gone to the little chapel where Thomas Campbell had once preached, and that is now a museum, but they had agreed to allow Ketcherside and some of those that were members of the church there in that area to meet there, and Ketcherside preached a sermon. And that night, as he was going home, they had ridden a bus back to Belfast, and he visited with some of the brethren. And then he walked the 2 miles back to the house where he was staying. It was wintertime, snow was falling, and he said in his autobiography, he says, "I've never experienced a greater sense of loneliness." Now, when he makes that statement, there's several things that's being said there. It wasn't that he was just by himself that night, but he was experiencing a sense of loneliness within the church, within the brotherhood of which he was a part. Because you see, there were a lot of problems that were going on. Anyway, I'll talk about that in just a moment, but he had this emotional trauma in his life that night. On the way home, he cried, he prayed, and he felt like that he was failing God in trying to bring about unity within the restoration movement. And so he made a determination that he was going to rethink and redo his life. Now, he went on to hold a couple of debates after this, but he reached a point in life when he wouldn't have a debate. In 1957, he started publishing some articles, Thoughts on Fellowship. When he did so, some of those that were close to him, like E.M. Zur, distanced themselves from him. Zur did not go along with Ketcher's side. There were others that distanced themselves. Some stayed with him, and they followed him. The churches in St. Louis that he was working with, they embraced him. Part of that is because they were followers of the man more than they were followers of the Word of God. I'm fully convinced of that. And that it was easy for that to occur. But Carl Ketcherside became more of an individual that was being persecuted then, in his mind, than ever before. He just thought that it had been difficult when he was the anti-college, anti-orphan home man. But when he made his decision on fellowship, most of the churches of Christ rejected him. And they turned their backs on him. And so he found his niche among the Christian churches, the independent Christian churches, where he was going to spend the next several years preaching and teaching. He made circuits on the college scene, lecturing at colleges, talking about Christian unity and talking about the need to be one in Christ Jesus. I copied this out of one of his books called Twisted Scriptures. He says, "I propose to regard all of God's children as my brothers. I intend to treat them as brothers. I have resolved to make nothing a test of fellowship which God has not made a condition of salvation. I shall accuse no one of being an antichrist who is built upon the one foundation simply because he differs with me about such things as instrumental music or the millennium. I will not allow our divergent views upon such matters to keep me from associating with any of my brothers or helping all of them." Well, let me talk to you just for a minute here about why I think that Carl Ketcherside made the change that he did. And I want to talk to you a little bit about some of his doctrinal views that he had. One of the reasons that I think that he made the change, there was a lot of diversity within the churches of Christ in his day. Prior to 1950, there were a lot of periodicals. This list that's right here, this is just the tip of the iceberg. I've just named some of those that are more well-known than others. But all of these periodicals were being published at the time that Carl Ketcherside was living. And they had a lot of different views. They had a lot of different things that they focused on. The Gospel Advocate, of course, opposed instrumental music and accepted denominational baptism. And they supported Bible colleges and orphanages. The Firm Foundation, which was a competitor with them, they opposed denominational baptism. If you read those early issues of the Firm Foundation, you'll find that's one of the big issues. Almost every other paper would have an article in regard to that, because that was a major thing, and they were trying to convert people about that. The Macedonian Call opposed church-supported colleges and orphan homes. The Christian Standard was the paper put out by the Christian churches. They accepted instrumental music. The Christian Evangelist also accepted instrumental music, but disagreed with the Christian Standard about some issues. There was the Old Paths Advocate, and many of the articles in it were opposed to multiple communion cups in Sunday school, and that seemed to be the big thing that was being written in that. The Apostolic Way opposed Sunday school. Mission Messenger opposed church-supported colleges and orphan homes and located preachers. That was a major issue with Carl Ketcherside. It was a sin, he believed, for a preacher to hire himself out to a church. He called located preachers fungi, and he said that they were leeches on the churches, and that they were doing more damage than they were good. There was the Bible banner. It opposed premillennialism, and every other issue had something about the premillennial doctrine in it. And then there's the Gospel Guardian. It also opposed premillennialism. And so all of these papers, as well as a host of others, there was fighting that was going on among people that held some things in common, but differed on so many different issues. And then something else that affected Carl Ketcher's side was the fractured Sommer family. He had held Daniel Sommer in the highest esteem in his early years, and then reached a point when he decided with a group of others that Daniel Sommer was not faithful any longer and needed to be marked and avoided. Fellowship needed to be withdrawn from him. And Carl Ketcher's side was close with D.A. Sommer, a son of Daniel Sommer, and many D.A. Sommer published the Macedonian Call. And then there was a rift that sort of grew between Ketcher's side and D.A. Sommer. And eventually, they grew apart. The Sommer family itself, D.A. Sommer disfellowshipped his father. Daniel Sommer's wife became the owner of the Apostolic Review, and she wouldn't allow her husband to write in the paper because she didn't think he was sound. And there was quarreling that was going on among the children as to who was right doctrinally and who was wrong. All of this bothered Carl Ketcher's side because he saw a family that was torn apart over doctrinal issues. And then it was his trips to England. The British Brethren have a different view of fellowship. They had a different view in his day, and by the way, they have a different view of fellowship today for those of you that make travels back and forth to Europe, and you go to worship in England. Just understand that there are things there that their fellowship is not the same as what we would hold to. But when Brother Ketcher's side went to England, there were brethren there that did not agree with everything that was being taught by the American churches, but they would accept anyone that would come in. They just wouldn't allow the preachers to come and tell them what they could do or what they couldn't do. They weren't going to be brought into the fighting that was going on among the churches in the United States. So Carl Ketcher's side embraced much of the fellowship attitude that the British Brethren have. And he makes the statement in his Pilgrimage of Joy. He says, if I had not made my trips to England, if I had not been in Ireland, in Belfast, I never would have changed. But it was one of those things that occurred in his life, and it changed him forever. Well, let's talk about the end result. I didn't really start at 7:30, so it's you had a song and a prayer. Let's talk about the end result of Carl Ketcherside's life. Leroy Garrett writes this little prologue to Pilgrimage of Joy about Carl Ketcherside, and he talks about Carl Ketcherside attending the International Convention of Itinerant Evangelists in Amsterdam, Holland, in 1983. And he talks about how the Carl Ketcherside was thrilled being there, and he embraced every religious organization, some that he had never heard of before, as long as they believed that Jesus Christ was the Son of God. He embraced the Anglican Church. He embraced the Catholic Church. He embraced everyone that said, "I believe in Jesus." And Carl thought, that's good enough. And so he became a voice in a very big sea that wasn't being heard anymore. Even brethren within the churches of Christ, one of the Christian churches, believed that Carl went too far in his pilgrimage of joy, as it would be. How did it affect others? Well, Irvin Waters may have been affected by it. Irvin took a similar view on fellowship. He and Carl Ketcherside were close friends. Carl writes of Irvin when he in his writings, and Irvin, of course, spoke fondly of Carl Ketcherside. There were others that were leaving the church during that time period. We had men like Leon Fancher who left the church. Carl Ketcherside had nothing to do with it, but there were a lot of brethren. When I was living in St. Louis, there were a lot of brethren, a lot of preachers, a lot of church members that would quiz me about Carl Ketcherside, and they spoke of him and the things that he taught, and they said, "We believe he's got a message." And I was always a little leery. Some of those men have gone on. They're no longer with us. Either they've died or they've just totally left us. And then there's modern day individuals. I don't know if they're being affected or not, but some of us are aware that Brother Jimmy Cutter teaches now that you don't have to be baptized to be saved. And did he get that from Carl Ketcherside? Or did he get that from someone else? I don't know. But that's where this leads. You know, brethren that start following after the things that are taught by Carl Ketcherside, they get to the point where they say, well, it doesn't matter. And if it doesn't matter, then you'll fall for anything. Let me just say this, and then I'll close. Carl Ketcherside made a distinction between gospel and teaching. And he would say in Matthew 28:19 that Jesus says, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel and baptize people, teaching them to observe everything that Jesus had commanded." And he said, preachers are supposed to preach and elders are supposed to teach. And that's why he was opposed to a located preacher. Now, he had a lot of difficulty. Folks would write in journals and they'd point out that, you know, Paul would say in Romans chapter 16 that the Romans had obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine. And I said, their doctrine seems to refer to the gospel. But Carl's statement about doctrine later, when he said doctrine doesn't matter, this was when he became liberal. What does that do to passages of Scripture like Acts 2 and verse 42, where it says the disciples continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine? Could we read our Bibles today if doctrine didn't matter and say the disciples continued, all they were doing was just believing in Jesus and every man did his own thing? Wouldn't the church have ended up just like Israel in the days of the judges? But instead, the Bible says that they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine. So, Brother Ketcherside, I believe that there is something that we have to do. We have to continue in the apostles' doctrine.